Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 8, Monday Night Football Edition. Plenty of things to cover on a very busy Monday morning around these parts. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, are you okay during bye weeks when your beloved Kansas City Chiefs get the Sunday off?
You did it again.
I know, I had
to. Yeah, I'm perfectly fine.
Okay.
We're just kind of lying in the weeds, picking up Kadarius Toney, just quietly. Quietly at 5-2.
Hey,
we got no shot. Chiefs can't win it.
No,
it's all about Buffalo.
We saw the best team in the NFL. Everyone knows it. We saw them Sunday Night Football against the Green Bay Packers go out there and win 27-17.
It's over.
So we may as well just
hand it to them already.
Send the Lombardi Trophy to Western New York. For Monday morning, as we always do, we'll kick things off with the good, the bad, the ugly. We'll get to a couple look-ahead lines, although there weren't major market adjustments around key numbers. A little injury update from our man Deepak, and of course, an in-depth breakdown of a showdown in the AFC North tonight between the Cincinnati Bengals and the Cleveland Browns. But Payne,
I'm looking forward to that.
I think it should be a lot more compelling than what it looks like on the surface. Let's put it that way. Although the way it's being bet from the people I've spoken to around town, they may as well not play the football game because the Bengals win this going away. But we'll get to that at the end of the show. Good, the bad, and the ugly. Always where we like to start things on a Monday morning, and I'm going to give you first honors.
I appreciate that. First off the tee box, let's go with maybe some low-hanging fruit here because I watched this game. It's close to me. We'd bet the first half over. Let's go with Tua and the Dolphins offense. And I know you think another part of that game was vital and caught your attention, but let's start with the offense there. And I you look at the metrics, right? I get that the Lions defense isn't any good. But you think about the Dolphins organization in past years, they've just never had the offense to catch up, you know? I mean, not a lot of imagination or creativity or just any ability to really battle back from being down double digits multiple times. And you look at the importance of that game. You know, Miami's either going to push to 5-3 or they're going to falter to 500. So I really thought that was a game offensive performance from them in chase mode. Final three quarters, Tua had a positive 0.66 EPA per dropback. So basically, anytime Tua would drop back to throw, those passes were almost yielding 0.7 points each time. And to this point, Tua, number one in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation for 8 weeks, for week eight, rather. And the one thing that's interesting here before we discuss the other side of the ball, I would like Mike McDaniel to come out with the pedal to the floor. If you notice, Miami's a little quirky offensively. Unless they're really being pushed, McDaniels is kind of willing to settle in and run and play a little bit more controlled. We obviously know he's a former run game coordinator. I think there's also this element of trying to protect Tua that's layered in there. But you have to start the game with the governor off, build some leads, because you're not always going to be able to play the Lions and catch up from double digits. So that's the one thing that's a little bit annoying there about Miami. But ultimately, playing catch up, the offense came alive.
They did some of that on the opening drive on Sunday Night Football the week before against the Steelers. I mean, it was the most creative opening drive. They go right down the field, get seven, and you're thinking to yourself watching that game, and I know we're talking about obviously yesterday's game against the Lions, Miami is going to be able to do what they want when they want against the Steelers defense. Fast forward to what the Eagles did in the first half, and you begin to go, okay, why doesn't Miami do that? And to your point, again, yesterday, they didn't really get outside of the box until they found themselves in that double-digit deficit. One that was largely dug by a defense that looked like they didn't start the game until halftime. And that's actually the group that I wanted to highlight for Miami's 31-27 win. An interesting result for sportsbooks with that game falling four, knowing that the public and professionals actually got out there, laid the 3 and 3.5. What did you see schematically that Miami did differently in the second half? I know they were only out there for three drives for Detroit, but they were able to force two punts, something that they couldn't do through the first 30 minutes of that football game.
it's always the interesting dynamic and why there's some variance in these games, because you would think if the Dolphins can get a little pressure on Goff, that's the element. But if Goff has time, he's going to be able to pick apart a secondary that's a little beaten and battered. It's basically Xavien Howard and Javon Holland. The Dolphins are down a starting safety, a starting corner, a starting slot corner, and that ultimately was the game within the game. If you can get pressure before Goff can get an open receiver, you're going to have a chance there. So ultimately, that's what unfolded. They stopped the run a little bit better in the second half as well, and the offense maintained possession well while scoring some points.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on the key point there, and we talked about it, I want to say, a couple of years ago with the Dallas Cowboys when they were rebuilding their defense. The only way that the defense's numbers were going to look better was with the offense putting together long, sustained drives, keeping them rested. And if they were out there a ton, it was going to show up on the scoreboard. So a good second half from the Miami Dolphins. To your point, they get to 5-3 in the division, one that looks significantly more competitive on paper now than we probably would have anticipated early in the season. I want to go to the AFC South, and it's a team that we've picked apart for the last couple of years, one that I've been overly critical of, and I think rightfully so. They now find themselves in first place, and that was the Tennessee Titans. Look, they didn't do anything, Payne, to reinvent the wheel. They didn't put Malik Willis in positions where he could cost them the game, but the Houston Texans knew it was coming, still couldn't stop it. I mean, Derrick Henry puts the entire team on his back yet again. 32 carries, 219 yards for a pair of scores. It's now four straight games of 100+. He's carrying it 22 times. We keep talking about when the tread on the tire is going to wear off and Derrick Henry's going to fall off a cliff. This guy only gets better the more touches he gets, and what it allowed the Tennessee Titans to do is to protect that defense as well. They got off the field on third down, held the Texans to 2 of 14, and they held the Texans to 161 yards of offense, or 3.2 yards per play. Look, I'm not going to call the Titans a Super Bowl contender by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to piss everybody off in the Volunteer State and in the city of Nashville, but they went out there, they executed a game plan, and Mike Vrabel, to his credit, at least knows the strengths and weaknesses of this football team.
Well, they're not. So I don't think any reasonable fan would think this is a Super Bowl contender. Now, kudos to Derrick Henry. The guy had 190 yards after first contact. The Texans got steamed. Part of it was the quarterback change. But Houston's responsible for some of this. I mean,
oh, there's no doubt. I mean, I'm not absolving Houston of this. I mean, put 13 people in the box. Put your cheerleaders out there, your front office. Do something to slow him down.
Add another human, another life form into the box. But, I mean, the Texans came in third worst in defensive rush efficiency. They were down two starters along the D-line. I think you just question what the heck Lovie Smith was doing. And I know by percentage, people will look at it and see Derrick Henry went against a loaded box at the third highest rate, and it sounds fine. Once it's obvious Malik Willis can't complete the forward pass, like, why isn't that number 80%? Like, how could the defensive game plan be anything other than playing press man and having eight guys in the box virtually every snap? And that just wasn't the case.
I've seen the Titans' weapons on the outside. I might play 10 men in the box and dare Malik Willis to complete a pass more than 5 yards downfield.
Probably not a bad approach, especially yesterday. What do you have, 55 passing yards?
Yeah, it wasn't good. Wasn't good, Bob. That's for damn sure in terms of what he did, but they get a big win in the division, and the Titans, of course, will be featured prominently under the bright lights at Arrowhead this coming Sunday. Other good...
I've got you to start quoting a show that you have not yet
watched. I know. That's what makes it even better, but I do have it on the short list of shows that I will watch once the NFL season comes to an end. I took your advice. It may have taken me, 3 months to get all the way through Sons of Anarchy, but yet again, you do not let me down. So I have Mad Men on the list. It will be watched, and I know the listeners who are out there shaking their head right now in consternation can point a finger at me, call me an idiot, and tell me what I'm missing with that particular program.
Yeah, Mad Men's a little bit different, but it's fantastic. So that'll go on the watch list to end football season. All right, moving on.
Other
Where would
good.
You like to go?
Other good that you had, I have a couple running backs that I want to mention as well, but I want you to take the floor.
I think what's interesting here is, sometimes by Monday morning, the Thursday game is so far removed from your mind, you forget about it. But I was really impressed with Lamar Jackson in the second half. And think about what we've discussed over the last handful of weeks, because we've been trying to figure out why Lamar and the Ravens are struggling late in games. And the only thing that we could really come up with was fatigue, right? Lamar just has to do everything, whether it's the run game, whether it's the pass game. I mean, he's just doing so much. And then potentially defense is adapting and Greg Roman not making those halftime adjustments. But on a short week with travel, specifically Lamar Jackson, outstanding against the Buccaneers in the second half. 71% passing success rate, 0.91 EPA per play for Lamar over that stretch, right? Of all the quarterbacks to play in week 8, Lamar Jackson number one in second half EPA plus completion percentage above expectation. So I was really impressed with what Baltimore did. Started getting the ball out of his hands quickly, letting receivers make plays after the catch. Ground game got going. This is really a vital stretch for Baltimore when you think about things in the landscape of not just the AFC, but their own division, creating space and separation in the North. I mean, the Ravens right now, sixth easiest schedule from this point forward. Their main competition in Cincinnati, fourth toughest. So it's time to make a move for Baltimore.
Well, and the Ravens as well get a little gift from the scheduling gods. I mean, after that game on Thursday night against Tampa, they play one game over a 23-day stretch, I believe is what the math works out to, which is absolutely unprecedented. So if Lamar showed any fatigue, this is the time you sit in the cold tub, you go through your massage therapy, and you get yourself ready to go for a second half of the schedule that, as you mentioned, is extremely available for the taking for Baltimore to make a little bit of hay. Running back
and the other guys offensively, right?
Yeah,
Mark Andrews
Andrews
a little
back.
Bit dinged Bateman. Up. Gus Bateman, you know, running back there from Ohio State, whose name's escaped my mind.
JK.
Dobbs. Yep, Dobbins. There
yep.
you go. Yep.
So, I mean, there's a lot to be excited about for a Baltimore team who, again, you look at their record and go, man, this team could actually be undefeated if they held on to double-digit leads, something they've been extremely proficient in doing with Lamar's leadership so far. So I mentioned Derrick Henry. I want to throw a couple other running backs out there, and it's part of the reason when you do all of this, you talk about running backs being a dime a dozen, and I know that doesn't always translate from a fantasy football perspective to the way that you go, man, you know, I lose Christian McCaffrey, I lose Jonathan Taylor to top my lineup, I'm never going to be able to refill that productivity. Not the same for NFL teams. Deontay Foreman steps in as RB1 for the Carolina Panthers in the wake of the Christian McCaffrey trade. Gained a career high, 87 yards after contact, scores 3 touchdowns in his first start of the season. Foreman has now gained 175 yards after contact over the last 2 weeks, trailing only Derrick Henry and Tony Pollard in that span. And I may as well mention Tony Pollard as well. We've been banging the drum for this guy to be featured more in the Cowboys offensive attack. 15 touches, nearly 150 yards and 3 touchdowns, 64 rushing yards over expected, his most in a game over the last 3 seasons. And when you look at Pollard, he's gained 192 rushing yards over expectations, the third amongst running backs. And I'll throw one more in there for Chicago Bears fans out there. Maybe eventually the Bears will realize that Khalil Herbert is the most dynamic option they have in the backfield. It's not a knock on David Montgomery, it's just facts.
Dante Foreman was wildly efficient again yesterday, and he made comment about how much him and CMC got along, but this is a business, this is a profession, and this is a guy who's been cast and out of the league for small stints. And he said, this is my opportunity to step up and prove to guys that I belong in this league. And sure enough, that's what he's done the last 2 weeks, taking the bull by the horns. And he has really helped this Carolina offense. When you think about PJ Walker, certainly made a fantastic throw late in that game, which Patty Mahomes tweeted about and said was the best throw of the season thus far. But guys were wide open in that secondary, and as many passing yards as PJ Walker had, his completion percentage was nearly 11% below expectation. So getting that ground game going, and quietly, the one thing that we thought this offense did in the offseason was improve their O-line. Added a couple guys, drafted another, and they're starting to get some real push up front.
Yeah, man. Well, it could have been for the Carolina Panthers in that spot, but we'll get to why that game unraveled late, even with the ridiculous throw that PJ Walker made to DJ Moore streaking down the sidelines. Other good that you wanted to highlight? I have one thing left on my list, but I want to make sure we don't leave any stone unturned.
I think you have to look at the 49ers. There's one other one I have after this, but I was just impressed overall with what I saw, especially in the context of the Rams getting steam. Debo Samuel's out. 49ers are still missing some key defensive starters, and the Rams have extra rest and prep. And then San Fran trails early. So there's just so much working against the 49ers at that point, and then just poof, right? It just flipped. 49ers dominated the final 3 quarters on both sides of the ball. D'Amico Ryan's defense allowed a negative 0.16 EPA per play the final 3 quarters, just a 34% success rate for the Rams from that point forward. And I think, you know, what's kind of scary here for the Rams offense that's now, you know, trending towards one of the league's worst. The one fear you had in this game, protecting your quarterback, didn't actually unfold. 49ers only had 6 pressures on 37 dropbacks, and you still couldn't move the ball once the script wore off. Kyle Shanahan was a pig in shit, obviously, with CMC, right? The things he can do with that guy. And the final 3 quarters, 49ers were successful on 75% of their dropbacks. Led the league in EPA per play over that stretch. Jimmy G's completion percentage was 9% over expectation. He had a fantastic game, made a ton of high-level throws. It was just domination for the 49ers the final 3 quarters.
Yeah, you look at what CMC was able to do in his full debut, becomes the first NFL player since 2005 to hit for the trifecta: a passing touchdown, a receiving touchdown, and a rushing touchdown. And to break down some of those counting stats: 18 for 94 on the ground and a touchdown, 8 for 55 through the air and a touchdown, and 1 for 1 passing with a 34-yard touchdown pass. And if we're calling it the pony personnel, which apparently is what the 49ers have dubbed it, putting 2 halfbacks on the field with Jeff Wilson being the other, 77 yards and a touchdown, plus 7.1 EPA according to Next Gen Stats. That package was successful on 7 of 9 snaps. And for all of those Jimmy Garoppolo haters out there, Payne, and I know we talked about it before the show started, I don't think Trey Lance finds George Kittle in the back of the end zone with the throw he made against the Los Angeles Rams yesterday.
No, I mean, obviously, you know, Trey Lance brings a different dynamic, and hopefully he returns healthy and becomes the quarterback that the 49ers thought he could be when they drafted him. But Jimmy G is no slouch. He runs this offense quite well. Certainly when playing from a lead, he's a little bit more confident, and there's areas of the field that he is wildly efficient to. He does have some deficiencies, obviously, but yesterday he was fantastic, and they did exactly what we said they could do. The way the Rams defense is built, you can attack areas where their best players are not. So if you look at Jalen Ramsey, it looks like he had the game of his lifetime. He was honestly fantastic, but they kept the ball away from him. And even the throw to CMC down the sidelines, that's really the only place you can put that ball. So Jimmy G was on top of his game yesterday.
Had a number of Jets fans text me yesterday and go, you think the Jets would be in the mix for Jimmy Garoppolo if the 49ers are really done with him? Let me tell you, that apparently is the guy that Gangrene wants to bring in, because given when we transition from the good to the bad, Zach Wilson appears to be that low-hanging fruit.
Go for it.
Continues to make poor decisions. I mean, this is the guy that I think was disguised in the 16-9 win against the Denver Broncos, wasn't overly effective by any stretch of the imagination. And when you look at what he's doing, the press conference notwithstanding, which was pretty entertaining if anybody didn't have a chance to see it in the Woodward answers that Zach Wilson gave, almost like a high school kid being grilled about what he did on a Saturday night and didn't want to tell his parents. A 9 QBR on dropbacks under center, comfortably the worst mark in the league. It was terrible, as I said, against the Broncos the week before. I mean, when you look at Zach Wilson, the metrics don't lie. This guy is terrible under pressure. He's just not making good decisions. And even his QBR in the pocket at 53.6, it's not bad. It's 14th in the league. He's averaging a hair under 8 yards per attempt. So there's reasons to understand why the Jets feel that he can be the quarterback, but you watch him, and right now for me, he doesn't pass the eye test for anything he's doing, for either extending plays or just throwing the damn football away to get it out of harm's way, knowing that the Jets defense is greatly improved and he doesn't have to be the difference maker every time he's out there to keep this team in football games.
Yeah, it's tough because you like what you see from Zach Wilson in terms of the arm strength, the mobility, at times the accuracy, but it's just something upstairs isn't clicking. To your point, he thinks he's this gunslinger, and right now the way the Jets defense is played, he doesn't need to be. But again, this week, quarterback 26 out of 30 that have played so far, an EPA plus completion percentage above expectation, a number of costly turnovers, and those numbers look even worse if you strip out the final drive, where if the Patriots make a normal tackle on Mims, it's a 10-yard gain instead of 65 or whatever it was. And that's distorting some of these numbers to make Zach Wilson look even better than his poor performance yesterday. It was really that bad, but that's how we kind of handicapped the game. We thought that Belichick would give him some troubles. He'd given him trouble in previous matchups, and it came to fruition again yesterday, thankfully for us and our listeners.
What I didn't anticipate was Mac Jones struggling as much as he did, and thankfully we got bailed out at the end of the first half in more ways than one with the pick six that wasn't. But yeah, Zach Wilson clearly, at least for right now, appears to be the weak link on the Jets offense, and maybe for better or worse, they'll be able to figure out what they have because he can't lean on a running back as dynamic as Breece Hall, who is unfortunately lost for the season. Other illustrations of bad football that you saw during the course of week eight?
I think if you looked at the coaches like stocks, you would be really, really hard pressed to find what was once thought of as a blue chip asset in Frank Reich to just come crashing down. And we started to see Frank clam up in recent years, and now the initial game plans aren't great either. And kind of just forget for a minute whether it was a right or wrong decision to bench Matt Ryan when you're tied for first place in your division. But the way Reich in the Colts kind of shaped this decision was, we can't protect. We need more mobility at quarterback. How many designed runs did Sam Ellinger have in the first half? The answer is zero, right? It's like, what
did Frank
Reich...
That was a trick question. That was unfair. You were leading the witness.
Yeah. Like, what did he devise for Sam Ellinger to be confident and settle in early? I mean, there was just zero read options, zero designed runs early on. Ellinger looked like a freaking deer in headlights. If you look, he was quarterback 23 out of 28 in the first half in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation. And then in the fourth quarter, when it's crunch time and you have, you know, a lucky two-score lead despite being outgained by a significant margin at that point, your defense gives up drives of 82 and 89 to a backup quarterback that wasn't good enough to start over the quarterback you kicked to the curb this offseason in Carson Wentz.
Oh, Taylor Heinicke. That's Taylor Heinicke slander around these parts. He went out there with the gunslinger mentality in that final 10 minutes against the Colts.
And Terry McLaurin just won a 50-50 ball, just yanked it away.
An absolute dude with that play, pulling it away from arguably a first ballot Hall of Famer in Stephon Gilmore.
And you look, I think Frank Reich is on the hot seat, and it's something I can't believe I'm saying, because you just go back, what, 16, 17 months to like January of 2021, and I remember we're all running over men, women, and children to back the Colts +7 in a playoff game at Buffalo. Like, that's what we were doing. We were trying to sprinkle the money line in that game. Now, they came up short, lost by 3, but that's how much we thought of Frank Reich at that time. And it's just, I don't know, it's completely changed. And you don't necessarily want to go down that path, but you start to think of some of the decisions that Chris Ballard has made and Frank Reich has made with some of the quarterbacks that they've chosen, and they're more personality fits than football fits, right? And everyone has their beliefs, and if you're into religion, that's awesome. But you start to think about some of the quarterbacks that they've taken, they're all personality matches. They're not necessarily football matches. And to this point, that's caused the Colts to not run away with a division that is not very good. And it's been multiple seasons with that happening.
I mean, you talk about running over men, women, and children. That Colts price to win the AFC South before the season, I mean, +120-ish thereabouts. You see that number get steamed, close as high as -150 at some shops. And right now, I'm not sure anybody would want a ticket there, knowing that there still is a decent amount of runway for the Colts to make up ground on the Tennessee Titans for that top spot. To your point, though, you just don't see anything that they do exceptionally well that leaves you brimming with confidence, thinking, okay, this is just short-term variance we have to go through. And the other group of disgruntled people out there, those folks that drafted Jonathan Taylor, #1 overall in fantasy, he's not even the guy that got the goal line touch when Nyheim Hines ends up finding Pater to extend that lead midway through the fourth quarter.
People are punching air right now, especially once CMC paired with Kyle Shanahan. That's going to... Not good, Bob. Not good.
No, not good in the least. Other coaching blunders, and I'm not sure where to point the finger in this particular game. It's one that we were involved in from a financial perspective that didn't go the way we drew it up from the total side. But the Las Vegas Raiders, they go on the road to New Orleans and put up a goose egg against the defense that hadn't shown all that well. The last time we saw them was on Thursday Night Football, albeit with extended rest coming into the Raiders game, where Arizona was able to move it. And it was, whether it was legit no-show, I'll let you share some of the metrics that you had there. But Derek Carr finishes the football game 15 of 26 for 101 yards, less than 4 yards per attempt. We know Darren Waller was touch and go all week, but he'd been an afterthought for what the Raiders had done offensively. Davante Adams, yep, one catch for 3 yards on 5 targets. Hunter Renfrow, one catch for 6 yards on 2 targets. Right when you want to think that the Raiders are turning the corner with a win against the Houston Texans, where they found another gear in the second half, they go forward on the road and put forth that kind of effort. And effort might be a loose interpretation of what we saw for 4 quarters.
Yeah, certainly when you're that poor offensively, it's on you. But I think we got to give the Saints defense some credit. And that's ultimately what we've seen unfold this season, are these anomaly performances. Because, you know, Dennis Allen, we thought coming into the season, was just going to have a rinse and repeat defense, right? We thought it was going to be elite like it'd been the last handful of years, and you had players coming out and sending tweets that, you know, this is going to be one of the best defenses in the league. Saints defense had been mostly a fraud this year. I mean, they entered the game 22nd in schedule adjusted efficiency in the two key areas that were quite shocking when you think about the players they have. New Orleans was dead last in pressure rate. They were 31st, allowing more than 2 yards per rush before first contact. And the two things they did yesterday against the Raiders was pressure Derek Carr in 41% of dropbacks and completely remove Josh Jacobs from the game, both by game state and then even when Josh Jacobs did touch it, just 4.5 yards per touch. And you think about this, Todd. Prior to the final drive of the game, which qualified as garbage time, down 24-0, the Raiders' longest drive was 27 yards to that point, and they hadn't entered Saints territory all day.
Not a good look. Not a good look in any sense of the word, by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, just certainly when it's that bad, it's on the offense, it's on the script, it's on the game plan. But you do have to give the Saints some credit there, because defensively, they were getting after it. And that's the one thing that we've seen. Really, when you break down a Raiders game, can you get pressure on Derek Carr? And if you watch him, held onto the ball a touch longer than average yesterday. I believe it was like 2.8 seconds to throw. Average was like 2.68 for yesterday's game, as among the quarterbacks that had played yesterday. And even, you know, on some of the throws, like pressure in under 2.5 seconds, I believe the league rate yesterday was 16%. Derek Carr was up to 20% pressure rate. So it wasn't even like that dramatic. Just, I'd love to go back. I'm going to watch the All-22 there and just see what was going on, because maybe it was the Saints secondary just dominating in coverage. Without Marshawn Lattimore, you didn't think that would be the case. But to your point, Davante Adams was on a milk carton yesterday, and the one time he did catch a pass, refs took it away from him. So that's just a wild game to watch unfold, and a little bit of the variance that we've seen play out through the course of this season, where you got the Saints defense you thought you had coming into the season for the first time all year. After 8 weeks.
Which, you know what? Hey, look, maybe the Saints should be optimistic now, because that division is right there for the taking. And so suddenly a New Orleans team that's been beaten and battered, sitting at 3-5, under normal circumstances would think they were looking up at a mountain to try and catch Tampa for NFC South supremacy. But if that's the Saints defense we see going forward, the offense gets healthier, suddenly we're talking about maybe the team to beat in that division until Tampa figures things out. The biggest question that I had in that game, Payne, was, did they play the second half with a running clock? I mean, Vegas is playing from behind. There's 3 offensive drives that they put forth, and it was nothing impressive. I mean, 5 plays, 16 yards, taking 3 minutes, which I didn't think was mathematically possible when you're chasing a 24-0 deficit. Then you put together a 9-play, 20-yard drive that takes 5 minutes off the clock. And then, most impressively, they garbage time drive, 14-play, 64-yard march, 3 minutes and 33 seconds. But a game I'm sure the Raiders will look to throw away, in a season where they've thrown a lot of things away as regression has bitten them in the rear end a number of times. As far as other bad, again, I don't like to take the cheap narratives that are out there, and so I'll make it a little bit more open-ended question, because I thought we saw a couple of good things in the second half for the first time in a long time from the Green Bay Packers offensively. But Green Bay, Tampa, and the Rams, of all of those 3 teams with veteran quarterbacks that had high expectations coming into the season, is there one that you think at least has a silver lining to the second half of the season?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's you hit me with the TV question because these are the comparisons that everyone's having, right? Just, Super Bowl contender, Tom Brady,
they're not
Aaron Rodgers.
They're not contenders. I mean, I haven't seen anything that says contenders. I'm just trying to figure out if there's reason for
optimism. It's the NFC, right? It's the conversation we're having within the NFC who's actually good.
It's
so
a great point.
It isn't very difficult for any of these teams to get their shit together and reel off a couple wins.
Yep.
I just don't know what Green Bay is. And, you know, we watched it unfold last night where they were able to get their ground game going. And there's just not a lot of pop there in the offense. Unfortunately, Christian Watson went down early in that game. Romeo Doubs made some great catches, and he shows flashes. But I said what I said in the breakdown of that game, and I think everything was pretty much pinpoint accurate in that we made the game like 10.4. It fell 10. And when you watch them, the one guy in the current makeup of both talent and production that they have on offense is Aaron Jones.
Guy's incredible.
Romeo Doubs, you see it from Romeo Doubs in flashes. I mean, the catch in the back of the end zone was ridiculous the way he contorted his body there, but you're not getting it from him quite yet on every down. He's a rookie receiver 8 weeks into the season. And, you know, A.J. Dillon, that's great. You can turn a 3.5 yard run into 7 two or three times a game by just being a Brahma Bull. But, you know, what else is there? You know, what else is freaking there? Big Bob Tonyan still kind of working his way back. Every time he gets himself up off the ground, it looks like he's 87 years old. He's just still recovering from the knee injury. So you do wonder what's going on there. The Buccaneers, I think I view a little bit differently than the Rams. I mean, you know, we touched on the Rams game a little bit more specifically to the 49ers. But to me, I think the Rams and the Buccaneers are a little bit different because we don't think as highly of Byron Leftwich as Sean McVay. And putting, you know, week 8 in context, like Tampa Bay had 3 days to fix things. McVay and the Rams had 2 weeks extra prep and face an undermanned 49ers defense that had literally just given up 72 points the prior two games.
Great point.
And one of the main reasons, like, if you were to beat the 49ers in that spot, right, you were saying, hey, we need to be able to protect the quarterback. Stafford was only pressured on 16% of his dropbacks. And once McVay's script and game plan wore off, which he spent 2 weeks devising, right, like Bubkis, of the 28 teams that played so far this week, the Rams were dead last in EPA per play in the second half, -0.43 EPA per play. And, you know, the team that we bet against in the Jets, they were the second worst. But the drop-off was substantial, 0.29. just to give you an idea of what the Jets offense did. And that's just how bad the Rams were offensively yesterday in the second half. And you thought about some of the weapons, right? Like Van Jefferson was back. He was going to solve some issues. I don't know what's going on there offensively, but it's not good.
I think the craziest part about the Rams, because everyone always thinks about Cooper Kupp, you think about a high-flying offense, but the common denominator for some of the Rams' struggles, as we put a bow on the bad category, is when they don't have a ground game, they just don't have enough when known passing situations. So maybe Kyren Williams returning from injury helps give them a little bit of a boost there. I'm not sure Ronnie Rivers was going to be the answer in the backfield with Darrell Henderson dealing with, you know, illness or whatever kept him, you know, out of practice earlier in the week. We know about the off-field stuff with Cam Akers a bit. So clearly the Rams have to show a little bit more balance, work off of play action. It can't just be Cooper Kupp, and we'll see exactly how effective he is. And when the Rams take on the Bucs in a revenge game from last year's postseason this coming Sunday. All right, ugly time pain, and it's something that you pointed out to me that I've noticed, but you articulated it much better in the breakfast football that we saw across the pond at Wembley Stadium. Trevor Lawrence, I want to give you the floor.
I mean, we talked about it last week, I think, in the same spot, and then we broke it down. And when we talked about the London game on Thursday, it's just Trevor Lawrence is just loaded with talent, you know. But it is tough to watch yesterday and think about having a completion percentage 8% below expectation when you have the third lowest intended air yards. And the one thing we kind of highlighted in our breakdown on Thursday was Denver has to stop the run to force Jacksonville to attack its defensive strength. That didn't happen, right? Like Travis Etienne went freaking wild. The Jags were 7th in EPA per rush this week. 59% of the Jags runs graded successful. So Trevor Lawrence had the run game support. And you could see Lawrence was confident early in the game plan, the script. But as soon as that first, you know, like, WTF interception comes, he just loses all confidence. You can see it on his face. You can see it in his body language. And even then, like just as a whole, it's not all Trevor Lawrence. This is still a Jacksonville thing. They're young. They have lots of new parts being integrated. There's lots of guys that have come from other teams where the mindset is someone else will step up, and now all of a sudden it's Jacksonville paid me, I need to be the man, and that role reversal is a little bit difficult, and we saw it unfold late. I mean, Jacksonville needed a stop, right? The defense could bail out Trevor Lawrence, and instead, the Jags let a bottom five offense go 80 yards for the winning drive, and we said this a couple times the last few weeks. Jacksonville just hasn't figured out how to win yet, but it's very clear there is some year-over-year improvement.
It's a team that, I mean, and you say it, you lay out the progression. You lose big, then you lose small, then you win small, then you win big. Jacksonville checks a number of those boxes, and maybe that light will come on for Trevor Lawrence. To your point, we've seen some of the flashes early in the year when he exceeded expectations. They got off to a 2-1 start during this five-game losing streak. I mean, the numbers have been downright awful, from poor decision-making to his QBR, his completion percentage above expectation, especially when he's under duress. And, you know, history repeats itself. You throw a costly interception in the end zone on a rollout sprint right against the Houston Texans, and you do it again on an early down against the Denver Broncos when, at worst, throw the ball into the stands, live to fight another day, and you can't afford to come away with a goose egg, especially against the team that had been struggling for an offensive identity. Final thing that I have for the ugly, I don't like to pick on kickers, but sometimes you have to. Eddie Pinheiro misses the extra point at the end of regulation to give the Carolina Panthers the win against the Atlanta Falcons. Now, I know it comes in the wake of a 15-yard penalty for DJ Moore for taking off his helmet after that 60-plus yard touchdown catch, but you miss a chip shot field goal. Clearly, Carolina trusted you to get the job done. That's a kick that you have to get made. I won't be shocked whatsoever if Eddie Pinheiro dusts off his resume and he's looking for new employment going forward, given everything that was at stake. But I want to make sure I didn't miss anything in any of the categories, good, the bad, and the ugly. Anything that you wanted to make sure we hit on before we move on to a couple of look-ahead line adjustments?
I mean, what a sly move from DJ Moore there. I mean, you catch the pass. It's fantastic. So you're stacking the incentives, right? You're showing, telling everyone that you care. And then you just conveniently take the helmet off, which contributes to a loss and a better draft pick in hopes that the guy throwing you the ball next year might be a CJ Stroud or Young. I mean, it was picture perfect from DJ Moore yesterday. That was a fantastic penalty. Hurt your team and hopefully get a better draft pick so a competent person can throw you the football next season. I think that was the goal.
You know what's going to happen in all of this? And not to go off on a college tangent, watch Anthony Richardson test off the charts in the combine and everything else. They're going to look at his measurables versus CJ Stroud, Bryce Young, and Anthony Richardson will be that guy at about 100-1 right now to be the number one overall pick, go rocketing up the draft board with a Josh Allen meteoric rise, because people go, you know what, we can work on accuracy, but we can't teach physicality or raw athleticism.
Yeah, that'd be something. Let's see if that unfolds. He's going to look fantastic in shorts, no doubt. You boggled my mind there. I don't really have anything more to say about Anthony Richards. I hope it works out for him because he's just loaded with talent, and certainly the ceiling is super high. But you know, we've kind of seen this from Anthony Richardson, right? Like, one of the guys that I really respect that does some rankings for 24/7. I mean, watched him play, and there's a reason why that type of specimen was only a 3-star recruit. It's because all of the issues he had in high school still has right now. So,
well, it's okay. I mean, as long as the Carolina Panthers aren't using the number one overall pick in the draft to select Will Levis out of University of Kentucky, I think there'll be reason to improve that quarterback position's overall body of work. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, as always, follow the Bet the Board podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And again, encourage you to subscribe to the Bet the Board newsletter. All the reminders about the great content we're putting out, articles, a bonus prop bet each and every week, some that cash by north of 100 yards if you get ahead of the market and take advantage of what's out there, like we shared with you this past Sunday. Look ahead lines, Payne. This is a surprisingly brief segment of the program. Thursday night football, the Eagles were a 9-point favorite on a Jalen Hurts homecoming game, returning to Houston to take on the Texans on a short week. Philadelphia -9. That number has ballooned out to -13.
Tight market this week. You're not seeing a lot of Monday movement, and for good reason. I thought the totals and some of the sides were priced pretty well. You'll probably see a little bit of movement here. Obviously, a first wave come in after we finish recording here, but overall, lines are pretty tight. And to your point, not a ton of movement with the look ahead lines. Eagles are obviously on fire right now. And the things that they can do offensively with establishing the ground game are going to work quite well against the Texans, even on a short week, right? You can come out with the ABC game plan and just impose your will and run right up the Texans' ass. So that is why we've seen this movement from 9.5 out to 13. The other thing that's a little bit concerning for the Texans, have not seen that maturation from Davis Mills taking a next step.
Yeah, if anything, he's looked to have regressed a little bit. I know he's not surrounded by a ton of weapons. Nico Collins was out this past week. Brandon Cook's on the trade block, but the number's not there for Davis Mills, and it's actually a quarterback that I thought was going to be able to take the next step. Houston, of course, will be very much in the mix to try and figure out if he's their guy going forward or if they will be looking to find a franchise quarterback towards the top of the 2023 NFL entry draft. Buffalo, another team that started with an expensive price that just got to be more expensive when they'll make the trek across the state from Western New York to the lovely Meadowlands of New Jersey at MetLife Stadium to take on the Jets. Bills, 10.5 out to 13.
Yeah, so no real travel here. And so that's part of this. Obviously, Buffalo will have to check some injuries. Jordan Poyer injured his elbow, said he heard a pop. So let's see if he's available for this game. I think ultimately the Jets have performed quite well above expectation. Now they're hitting the difficult part of their schedule. And as it stands right now, the Jets have the toughest remaining schedule in the NFL. And so they're going to be stepping up in class while they're still trying to figure out how to win games. You have a deficiency at quarterback. And you're missing some weapons now within that offense. It's not just Breece Hall, who was doing things well above running back expectation, but you're without your starting right tackle in Vera Tucker. And so a guy that we know behind center that isn't great under pressure is now probably going to be dealing with more pressure without his right tackle. And we've seen Dwayne Brown return from injury, and he's kind of been a shell of himself at age 37. So there's some concerns here. And I think when you look at the defensive side of the ball, where Robert Saleh has added more talent, they really haven't played a great run of offenses. And this will certainly be a massive step up in class. I don't lay 13 on the road, but at this point, I'm not making a case for the Jets either.
Did you happen to see the postgame press conference with Elijah Moore?
I did.
I'm not sure.
He answered it. He answered it honestly.
Yeah,
I understand the context, and people probably don't want to hear that from a second round pick and think he's being a negative Nancy for a team that started extremely well. How is he not involved in the game plans?
I have no idea.
How is he not involved in this offense? I mean, we saw what he could do last year when he was the only option, and he was healthy last year towards the end of the season. Without a great quarterback throwing the ball, he was dominant. I don't understand. I mean, that's fine. He's in the doghouse. Get it figured out. Maybe throw him a football or two and he might get himself out of the doghouse. He might actually be content. How do you not get that guy the football?
It's one of the bigger mysteries that I honestly thought was going to be solved once Elijah Moore was paired up with Zach Wilson again. Because to your point, when you look at how he finished down the stretch in two of his final three games, he was targeted 11 times or more. He ended up with 141-yard performance against Miami, which is kind of the breakout. Finishes with 77 yards against the Eagles, and suddenly he's an afterthought because there's new toys in the mix. So much so that Denzel Mims is getting the ball more often than Elijah Moore. So you wonder what's going on behind the scenes there with Mike LaFleur and how this Jets offense is working or maybe not working. So a player that you're going to want to keep tabs on as the trade deadline inches closer on November 1st. Last but certainly not least, the game that had the biggest movement, at least around a key number, a divisional matchup, and a contest that we saw a few short weeks ago. The Arizona Cardinals were a 3.5-point home favorite on the look-ahead number. Seattle knocks off the New York Giants, and here we are with the Arizona Cardinals now laying less than a field goal, 2.5, more or less the prevailing price.
Quick division turnaround here, and at a depressed price. Let's see if the Cardinals' offensive line is healthy. I know last week early on at +6 and everything basically to 4.5 or better, there was some early money on the Cardinals. It was certainly the sharp side. And then ultimately what unfolded was people started reading the injury report and the Cardinals were down 4 starting offensive linemen. We obviously know Pugh is out for the year, but Rodney Hudson was out. DJ Humphreys ended up being a late scratch and Max Garcia was out as well. So you were down basically your left tackle to your right guard. Let's see if that's the case this week. You got to follow that injury report for the Cardinals offensive line in this one.
Yeah, and you almost did see them have a chance to sneak in the back door trailing 34-26 late, but the drive was ill-fated right from the start, and Arizona tickets end up in the circular file. You mentioned health for the Arizona Cardinals, and while it's always good for you and I to figure out what player availability means to the point spread, there's somebody that can better explain to us what timetables look like for some of the biggest names in the game to return to action, and that's why we bring in our good doctor, Deepak Shona.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chona. Stanford and Harvard-trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right, well, thank you, Todd. And here we go with your Bet the Board injury report, starting with Cooper Kupp. Now, the video suggests an ankle sprain. Even though it looked at least like a moderate severity injury on the video, he did walk off without assistance. And being able to put weight on it early does bode well. So we'd give him a solid chance of being able to play week 8. Not yet really guaranteed, but we'll see how practice reports develop on this one. Then we have Ja'Marr Chase, and he has a fracture in his hip and a torn labrum. The fact that Chase does have this small fracture in the hip actually does kind of work in his favor, because bone healing tends to be pretty reliable in this location. I'd anticipate his return about 5 weeks from the injury, or in other words, around week 12. This labrum tear is a bit of a wild card, because some of these do end up needing surgery. Most commonly, however, he would be able to play through this, and then if he needs it, could consider surgery in the off season. When he comes back, we would expect his typical stud level of play when he does return. Then we have Devontae Parker, who left the game yesterday with a knee injury. Video suggests an MCL sprain. The average on these would be 2 to 4 weeks, but he'll probably have to get an MRI on Monday to make sure his meniscus is not torn and this isn't something bigger that we're dealing with. Then we have Deebo Samuel. And Deebo missed the game with a hamstring strain. Most moderate severity hamstring strains take 3 weeks for wide receivers, so we'd expect his return to the field around week 10. Typically, wide receivers return at about 90% of their pre-injury production on a per-play basis, but they also initially carry this elevated, probably about 20%, re-injury risk for the first 2 games back. Then we have Mike Williams. Now, he got injured last week. Video suggested a severe high ankle sprain. These cost wide receivers 4 to 6 weeks in general. Now, performance dips do last the full 6 weeks, so even if he plays before that point, we would anticipate some limitations. Then we have his teammate, Keenan Allen. Now, the dud that Keenan Allen put up in week 7 was really not all that unexpected. Wide receivers returning from severe hamstring strains do tend to show their limitations until at least 6 weeks post-injury. That bodes well for his week 9 performance, which should be close to full strength as long as he doesn't re-aggravate the injury between now and then. On DeAndre Swift, he did play, but he didn't have the touches that we're used to seeing, and it wouldn't be crazy if that distribution between Swift and Jamal Williams was part of a plan to ramp Swift back up slowly, given that he was dealing with multiple injuries. It's not really clear how the snap counts are going to look next week, but we would expect a fully healthy Swift, given that he'll be 6 weeks out from injuries that usually average 4. Then we have Ezekiel Elliott. Now, the combination of a grade 2 MCL plus a thigh contusion or bruise would cost most running backs 3 to 4 weeks. Now, Zeke has historically been pretty aggressive about returning quickly, so we would lean towards closer to that 3-week timeline. 5 weeks post-injury is when our data projects the return of his full pre-injury productivity. Then, Alan Lazard. Now, the mechanism plus his comments together suggest a shoulder subluxation, which is like a partial dislocation where his labrum in the shoulder also tears. Skill position players average just over 2 weeks out. We would lean towards a return week 9 or 10 for Alan Lazard. Then we have Dalton Schultz. Now, expect him to continue to play and to continue to improve significantly over the next few weeks. Schultz has been dealing with a PCL tear, which has had the expected performance impact on the first half of his season, so he is a strong buy-low candidate for season-long owners. Then we have Gus Edwards. From the Thursday game, he has a hamstring strain, and hamstring strains post-ACL is not terribly uncommon of an injury. We did see Chris Godwin have this just recently as well, but we would lean towards the Ravens taking it slow because strong hamstrings protect that new ACL. So most likely here, probably missing 1 week. They do have the bye following that, and then likely to see Gus Edwards back strong after. And then we have his teammate, Mark Andrews. The video is a little hard to interpret, but it does suggest possibly an AC joint sprain of his shoulder. If that's the case, the average timeline would be 2 to 4 weeks for tight ends. With them having this week 10 bye, it wouldn't be surprising if he missed exactly one game and then came back after the bye. And that's all for now. I will throw it back to you, Todd.
A ton of relevant names that Deepak broke down for us, Payne. Obviously, we're optimistic as football fans that Cooper Kupp will be out there with a mild ankle strain. Was able to walk off, as Deepak mentioned, under his own power late in the game. The crazy part about it, Sean McVay taking responsibility for why Cooper Kupp was even out there when the game had long since been put out of reach at 31-14. Deebo Samuel, the hamstring, Mike Williams, he ain't coming back anytime soon. You look at some of the running backs that are out there. But of course, the big name, and I think it provides the perfect segue for us to go into the breakdown of tonight's game. Ja'Marr Chase, a fracture in his hip, torn labrum. We saw the Cincinnati Bengals make the decision not to put him on IR, hoping that being the freakish athlete that he is, he could heal a little bit faster and would be out in the mix. And as a result, you've seen a number move both on side and total for tonight's game. The Bengals now a 3-point favorite. You have to lay $1.20 across the board for their trip to Cleveland, but the totals come down from a peak of 47.5 as low as 45. Kevin Stefanski, 4-0 versus the Bengals as a Browns head coach, swept each of the last two seasons. The Bengals, they've lost 12 straight road primetime games, an absolutely meaningless streak, but a fun nugget to share when we go back to 1970. Joe Burrow gets to play under the bright lights for his first ever Monday Night Football start. And when you look at the Cincinnati Bengals, arguably one of the most undervalued commodities in the entire National Football League, not just this season, but going back to last year, they've now covered 5 straight. A cover this week would mark the longest streak for the franchise since 1993. And if you look over the last 15 games, that includes the postseason, the Bengals have exceeded oddsmakers' expectations in 13 out of 15. I feel the most logical place to start is how much different you think the Bengals' offense will look, if at all, without their number one alpha receiver in Ja'Marr Chase.
It's a good question, and I think a lot of sharp guys have started to gravitate towards the Bengals in the last handful of weeks. And even though they had the slow start, you thought there would be some cohesion within the offensive line once they started playing together with 4 new starters out there. And I think you're looking at a Bengals team right now that's positioned better than they were a season ago. And I think you're looking at a fringe top 5 type team. So I know all the Bengals fans hated us last year as we continued to told you or continued to say that there was a bunch of luck and some variants that were swinging their way. But I think even with the record that they currently have, they're in line to make a little bit of a run. But, you know, going specific to this matchup, I think we talked, maybe 2 Mondays ago about the offensive shift we saw from the Bengals, and now it's starting to receive some mainstream love. But Joe Burrow basically has transitioned back to the quarterback that we thought he was, and it's because Zach Taylor has allowed it to be his offense. And that's the one thing that we've seen the last 2 weeks. Shotgun usage up more than 18% the last 2 games versus the first 5 weeks. Burrow, you can tell, is just more comfortable being in the shotgun, being able to see the field and be that point guard and distributor. And then there's also been a little bit of a shift in play calling where, you know, we've kind of been pounding, I think, the table for 2 seasons now. Like, for the love of God, Zach, like, stop running as much on first down and second and long. Bengals, the last 2 games, passed the ball 22% over expectation. So you're starting to see them do the right things, and the offense has taken off, even if it is against a little bit of a lackluster schedule the last couple weeks. Now, you get a Browns defense that's 28th in pass efficiency, and they've played the likes of Mayfield, Flacco, Trubisky, Mariota, and Bailey Zappi. And certainly, you know, let's not exclude Justin Herbert and Lamar Jackson, who are both plus quarterbacks. But when the Browns played them, Herbert's dealing with torn rib cartilage and Keenan Allen's out. when it's Lamar, it's right. He's like downtrending metrically. He's playing with a hip injury, and both Mark Andrews and Bateman are extremely limited. So even when they played the better offenses, the Browns defense, you know, kind of got a lifeline with some of the weapons that were far less than 100%. Yes, Ja'Marr Chase is out here. It's a decent sized loss. But I think when thinking about, you know, Higgins and Boyd, Cincinnati's more prepared to play without their number one receiver than most other teams. And as much as I like Ja'Marr Chase, we expected some regression this season, and so far he's only playing 5% above replacement level when you adjust for schedule strength. The Browns also will be without their best corner in Denzel Ward, so that I think negates the loss of Chase some. JOK hasn't practiced this week, and he's in jeopardy of missing this game, and I think he's an elite cover linebacker, so maybe that frees up Hayden Hurst a little bit more than we would have initially expected. And then you may see Mixon get on the loose here, because the Browns' defense is horrific against the run, 27th, and they've been really, really gashed up the middle. Now, the one thing that I've been hearing and reading and, you know, seeing on social was, you know, Joe Burrow didn't look great against Joe Woods in the Browns defense last season. And so I dug in a little bit, and there's been some clear variance with those two games. If you look when Joe Burrow struggled last season, he wasn't great on third downs, and he was really poor in the red zone. And those are, you know, just very much variance based. There's not a lot of those opportunities in a game, but you go back to 2020, Burrow torched the Browns in both meetings. And this to me is just a different version of the Browns defense. I mean, there's, you know, 28th in schedule adjusted defensive efficiency. They're equally bad against the run and pass, and that's against a bottom 10 schedule of opposing offenses. So I think Cincinnati, even without Ja'Marr Chase, will have some ability here to move the ball, especially when you think about what they're doing now in the grand scheme of things, with more passing, with Joe Burrow more comfortable in what they're running, and just a really beaten and battered Browns defense, specifically in the secondary.
When you mentioned Joe Mixon, and of course these are counting stats, not to talk efficiency for those folks scoring at home. I mean, he's had big games against Cleveland before, including a pair of games back in 2019 where he went absolutely ballistic on the ground. You talked about the Browns' struggles against the run. You wonder if this is where you don't necessarily see all Joe Burrow operating out of shotgun. It's Joe Mixon running between the tackles to try and neutralize some of the threat that's very real coming off of the edge and keep Burrow out of harm's way against the likes of Myles Garrett, even knowing that the Cleveland Browns far from 100% in the defensive backfield, dealing with a laundry list of injuries, a couple that you highlighted, and players that have been questionable all week, who I expect to be out there in Greg Newsome and Greedy Williams, but clearly not operating at 100% in their own right. Now, when you look at the other side of the ball, this is a Cleveland Browns offense. It's going to look a little bit different. No David Njoku out with an ankle injury. Wyatt Teller out as well, a key cog along their offensive line. And Jacoby Brissett has been a real problem for stretches in terms of creating some balance. Last week, there was a little bit of optimism. He got Donovan Peoples-Jones involved, maybe a nice 1-2 complement with Amari Cooper, who is still the alpha. But let's not sugarcoat it, Payne. This Cleveland Browns offense runs through Nick Chubb, and if Nick Chubb can get on track, all bets are off because it forces teams to respect play-action passing. Do you think Lou Anarumo's defense struggles at all to contain Nick Chubb, or how do you see things playing out tonight when Cleveland has the football matched up against the Bengals defense that's been vulnerable in the first half but absolutely airtight in the second half, approaching on a levels of historical greatness for not giving up a touchdown through the first seven games?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think if you just kind of look on the surface, you would think the Browns offense has faced a really poor schedule of defenses, and they've had some troubles among, you know, playing those defenses, and that Cincinnati would be this huge step up in class. To me, it looks like Atlanta's dead last defense is skewing some of the metrics a bit, because Cleveland's actually played two top 10 defenses, four top 14 defenses, and five top 17 defenses. So I don't know if this will be as large of a step up in class as I initially thought, or the surface level metrics would indicate here. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, the Bengals defense is really good. It's eighth best in schedule adjusted efficiency. They've been really good against both the run and the pass. But there are some avenues here, I think, for the Browns to have some success. They showed last year with Nick Chubb healthy that they were able to run the ball right at Cincinnati and find some efficiency there. And you're looking tonight, the big fella, DJ Reader, out again up the middle for Cincy. The rumor there is potentially a return after the bye week. But for tonight, that's a big loss. And you can run on the Bengals defense specifically on first down. They're 30th defending first down runs. Now, obviously, that's going to be the objective, right, for Cincinnati to stop the run. But if Cleveland can get those first down runs to be efficient, it can keep Jacoby Brissett and the Browns pass offense competitive in my mind. And, you know, aside from last week where Brissett looked really good and he was able to hit some explosives and his intended air yards numbers were quite high, Cleveland as a whole really hasn't shown the ability to hit you deep or be overly explosive. It's very much a controlled pass attack. The one thing, though, to your point at the top, and it was astute, it's vital for Cleveland to get out early tonight. You just have to. For whatever reason, Lou Anarumo hasn't been great devising game plans, but he has been a wizard making halftime adjustments once he sees what you're doing. We did get a glimpse of that during the Super Bowl run last year, but right now, Todd, the Bengals defense, bottom 10 in EPA per play allowed in the first half, second best in the second half. So the Browns have to get some points on the board early.
When you look at Lou Anarumo's professional trajectory, did you ever think he was capable of doing what he's done so far with the Bengals?
No.
I mean, this is incredible to me because, look, we don't hold the Bengals.
I watched him at the Dolphins.
I was going to say, we don't hold the Bengals coaching staff, any of them, in the highest regard, and you look at the adjustments they're making, specifically on the defensive side. I mean, my God, I mean, these things are impressive on a historical level. I mean, not allowing a touchdown in the second half of this season, the last team to do this for the first seven games happened back in 1934. So to just wrap your head around what kind of historical precedents being established, I mean, is absolutely mind-boggling. So a hat tip to him. We'll see if Cleveland get out to a fast start, play with a little bit of lead. We know that this defense is built for some of that, but the Bengals, no strangers to coming back, knowing they have a prolific passing game. Have you seen anything on this? Did you see the move on the under coming in, or you think that's all injury-related to the absence of Ja'Marr Chase?
So there's a couple things going on here. You kind of hinted that it was one-way action on the Bengals, and I would say you're probably right there. I do know of one group that actually got out and laid it with the Bengals. We saw some buyback at 3.5, so there's a full-blown battle on the side. In terms of the total, it started to trend down a little bit, but I do think we saw the large move come with the announcement of Ja'Marr Chase being out, and I'm interested to see how this ultimately unfolds before kickoff, because there might be a little bit of a difference of opinion on this total as well. Keep your eye on the weather. It didn't look significant. There was some early morning rain, and we thought it would clear out a little bit quicker, but it looks like it might linger around a little bit before kickoff, about a 25% chance of rain for the game. So keep your eyes peeled there. The wind isn't significant by any stretch, but we've seen what happens sometimes when it can come off the water a little bit, and that where that stadium's positioned isn't great. So let's keep an eye. But I think ultimately what you're going to see here is some battles on both the side and total in this one.
Yeah, one thing on this too, and it's not advocating for a position either way here. It's more of a PSA to our loyal listeners, as I'm sure a lot of them will look for a little bit of action to try and hopefully roll some of their profits from a college football and NFL best bet winner on the podcast last week. If you like the underdog, do not take three on this game. There'll be plenty of 3.5s. I think you're going to see books that cater more to recreational bettors have their hand forced. We already see two of the more prominent shops nationally that deal to recreational customers in legalized jurisdictions at +3.5 minus $1.20. I see a shop here who fits that same profile out in my neck of the woods at 3.5. So wait this thing out if you like the underdog. The converse is also true. If you find yourself making a case for the Cincinnati Bengals, lay 3, not 3.5. We can't emphasize the importance of getting the best of the number often enough around these parts. It's hard enough to win as is, even more difficult if you handicap yourself, or self-sabotage, I should say, before you even go to the window to plunk down an investment.
I would absolutely concur, and I think ultimately when you're looking at games, and we mentioned this a little bit last week, it's not who you're betting, it's how you're betting. And when you get games around these key numbers of 3 and 7, you ultimately have to gauge your asymmetric risk, and it comes down to which side of the coin, because that debate depends on which side you actually like. So if you do like Cincinnati, you don't want to lose the 3. If you like Cleveland, there's probably a 0% chance you're going to lose the 3. And so it's worth waiting and taking that risk because you believe it's going to get 3.5. You believe it's going to get there. So ultimately, you're going to have to gauge risk as a bettor when you're playing around these key numbers. And it's just vital that to your point, if you are playing the Bengals, you want to be laying 3. If you're taking the Browns, you want to be taking 3.5.
Such an important lesson, and we know a lot of our listeners come at this skill with a variety of different attributes, levels of experience, but we like to try and reiterate some of the baseline points that allow you to keep your money in action a lot longer than you otherwise would if you're starting to display some bad habits out there. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Again, most importantly, as always, follow the podcast for all things Bet the Board, not just in the National Football League, at Bet the Board Pod. Payne, any other final nuggets, tidbits, little things you'd like to share before we come back? Get to do it all again with the college football slate on Wednesday.
No, we've ran long for Monday, well over an hour.
Yeah, that's what happens when you got a lot of bad quarterback play. You got to get it out there and try and dash that level of optimism that fans of piss poor football teams have when it comes to franchise quarterbacks in their sophomore seasons. Best of luck with all of your Monday Night Football investments, wherever they take you, side, total, or prop market. Hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.